I was talking about photons and light in general last time. And remember that a photon is not a material object. It is a little packet of energy, of light energy. And as I was saying, there are three possibilities when a photon encounters an object. It can either be transmitted through that object, it can be absorbed, or it can be reflected off in another direction. And if it is absorbed, it no longer exists. But of course, the energy still exists because energy can't be created or destroyed. So if a photon is absorbed, then that energy has to go somewhere, of course. Well, when a photon is absorbed by a pigment like chlorophyll, that energy goes into exciting the pigment molecule. What I mean by that is that intake of energy causes an electron to go up at least one energy level or shell. Remember, we talked about energy levels and shells, and the closer to the nucleus, the lower the energy. If an electron is excited, it will jump up at least one level, possibly more. And you can see that happening right here with a chlorophyll molecule that's not part of a plant. This is just chlorophyll isolated as a molecule. You have a solution of chlorophyll in here. This is not how it actually is in a plant. It's the same stuff, chlorophyll, but it's just on its own in solution. E minus is the electron. It goes to the excited state. Now that is very unstable. It wants to go back to that lower energy level, in other words. And if it does, it's going to lose energy just because it's going down in an energy level. And once again, that energy can't be destroyed. So if the electron loses energy by going back to where it was before it got excited, that energy has to go somewhere. So the original photon is destroyed by being absorbed. But to make up for the energy that has to be released when the excited electron goes back to the ground state, wherever it was before it got excited, a brand new photon gets created, containing the energy that is lost when this electron goes down back to the lower level. This is called fluorescence. So fluorescence is actual creation of light by something. You know, when you look at something with fluorescent paint, like a speed limit sign, if you're out in the middle of nowhere where there's no light, and your headlights hit a speed limit sign, it seems really bright. Well, it's not just it's not reflecting light back to you. The headlight photons get destroyed because they excite the electrons of that fluorescent paint. And then they immediately go back down to the ground state and create brand new photons that shine toward your eyes. So the paint is actually beaming light. That's fluorescence. Well, that would be a stupid thing to do for a plant, because that would totally waste the energy that's received by absorbing the original photon from sunlight. The whole idea of absorbing the sunlight photons is to receive the energy to power the endergonic process of carbon fixation to create sugar out of CO2. So if it fluoresced, if the chlorophyll fluoresced in a plant, that would be a total waste. And this is not chlorophyll in a plant, like I said. This is just isolated chlorophyll molecules. If you have such a solution and you shine light on it, it will fluoresce. But in a plant, the way it's organized disallows it from fluorescing. And instead, the energy that's received by absorbing the photons is put to use. Okay? So let's see how that's done. In slide 10, we're looking at a tiny little section of membrane. This is not the plasma membrane. This is the thylakoid membrane. Remember, a chloroplast has an outer membrane, an inner membrane, and a thylakoid membrane. This is thylakoid membrane. And there are millions of copies of this thing that we're looking at. But this one thing that's embedded in the membrane, this one copy of it, is called a photosystem. And a photosystem has a couple major parts to it. This is a cutaway view, so you're seeing the interior of it, but it would wrap around all the way. Kind of looks like a purple bell pepper. These purplish parts that go all the way around it are the so-called light harvesting complexes. And they're mostly protein, but embedded in them are, represented by green here, pigment molecules. So chlorophyll A, chlorophyll B, and carotenoids, a mixture of pigment molecules. And pigments, by definition, can absorb photons, right? That's what makes something a pigment. So that's why these parts are called light harvesting complexes. They contain the pigments that actually absorb the photons, if the photons actually hit in the right places. You know, there's trillions and trillions of photons in a tiny beam of light even, and the majority of those just won't hit a pigment. So they'll go through or bounce off the plant without doing any good. But a bunch of them do, just by chance, hit pigment molecules. Okay, the interior in lighter blue is called the reaction center complex. And that contains a special pair of chlorophyll A molecules, as you see here, that will actually be excited eventually. But let's go through this in order, how this works. Any one of the various pigment molecules that are embedded in the light harvesting complexes can be excited by a photon coming from sunlight and absorbing that photon. That excites the electron, just like I was talking about in fluorescence. All right? If it were fluorescing, it would just immediately create a new photon and shine it away. That would be the waste. But because of how it's complexed with these proteins, that fluorescence is disallowed. Instead, whichever one of these pigment molecules, and it doesn't have to be this one, it just is in this example, whichever one gets excited, that excitation gets transferred from one pigment molecule to a nearby pigment molecule. And the particulars of how this happens is well beyond the scope of this course. But the mechanism by which that happens is called resonance energy transfer. It allows for excitation to be transferred from one excited pigment to another pigment without creation of a photon. That would be wasteful. So a photon strikes one, excites it, and then the next one gets excited, and the next one excited, and so on. It bounces around to various pigment molecules, exciting them along the way, and then eventually the excitation will get passed to this special pair of chlorophyll A molecules that are in the reaction center complex. And not only does that chlorophyll get excited, in a sense it gets super excited. It gets so excited that the electron doesn't just jump up an energy level, it completely leaves the molecule. It ionizes it, in other words. Right, the electron actually leaving, which is what this up arrow with the E minus is, that electron is not going to any longer be part of this chlorophyll molecule. It leaves. And where does it go? To this blue square, which represents something called the primary electron acceptor. Which is similar to what oxygen does for us in cellular respiration, right? It serves as a final electron acceptor, something that will gladly take that electron. That's what the primary electron acceptor is. So, chemically speaking, what is happening to the primary electron acceptor when this happens? It's becoming reduced. And what do you associate that with? Right, but specifically the reduction part. When something becomes reduced, it's now carrying more energy, right? So this primary electron acceptor, when it's reduced by the electron that comes from this chlorophyll, is carrying energy just like NADH is in cellular respiration, and can deliver it, can drop it off just like NADH does. Okay? So this is how energy of sunlight gets captured. It gets captured in the form of a reduced electron acceptor, which can then pass that energy in the form of electrons onward. All right? That's a photosystem. Let's go to 11 now and look at how this works to accomplish the goal of the light-dependent reactions. The light-dependent reactions use sunlight as the input of energy, and they accomplish creation of high-energy molecules in the form of NADPH and ATP. Remember that those are the two energetic requirements for the light-independent reactions, or Calvin cycle, that actually assembles the sugar using carbon dioxide. The energy required for that has to be in the form of ATP and NADPH. Well, the light-dependent reactions create both of those energy-carrying molecules using energy that's captured from sunlight by photosystems. Now, I said that there's millions of copies of these photosystems, and there are, but there are two types. So there's millions of copies of both types. And they are called photosystem 1 and photosystem 2, kind of boringly. But the confusing thing about this is that the first one to operate is photosystem 2 and then photosystem 1. And the reason it's backwards is simply because we happen to discover photosystem 1 first. The second one to operate, we called it photosystem 1 because we discovered it first, but when we discovered the other one, we realized it works first, and we didn't change the names. Okay, so there's two kinds of photosystems working in combination with each other, photosystem 2 and photosystem 1, both shown here. These are similar to each other, but they feature different reaction center chlorophylls. And they're both embedded in the thylakoid membrane, and there are millions of copies of both. But one of each working together forms kind of a functional unit. All right. Now, between these two photosystems, also in the membrane's not shown, but it's here, embedded in the membrane between photosystem 2 and photosystem 1, are protein complexes making up an electron transport chain. Very similar to the electron transport chain in the mitochondrion working for the purpose of cellular respiration that we already discussed in last chapter. All right? Let's see what happens here. You have light striking, hits one of the chlorophylls or carotenoid pigments, excites it, resonance energy transfers that excitation, eventually it reaches the reaction center complex, and that chlorophyll gets so excited that it completely loses its electron to the primary electron acceptor. That primary electron acceptor doesn't keep the electron very long. It immediately then passes it off to the first member of the electron transport chain between the two photosystems. Is this all making sense? Well, you already know how electron transport chains operate. One member passes to the next, it's a redox reaction, and then to the next, and so on. A little bit of energy is released because the electron gets lower and lower in energy level as that happens. If this were in the mitochondrion, the electron transport chain that you already studied, in other words, what is the purpose of that? What does that accomplish?
Create ATP?
Not directly. That's the ultimate goal. But what is the direct consequence of electron transport in cellular respiration? Of what? Correct. It creates a proton gradient because as the electrons trickle down through the chain, that release of energy powers members of the chains as pumps to pump protons from one side of the membrane to the other. Right? Creating a gradient. Well, that's exactly what happens here. This electron transport chain between the photosystems works the same way for the same purpose. It doesn't do it this, it's not made of exactly the same complexes, but it works the same way. And you can see ATP coming out of here. That's the result of the gradient, right? Once you have the gradient, then you have the ability for diffusion of protons back through the membrane to turn ATP synthase molecules to make ATP out of ADP and inorganic phosphate. Exactly the way it does in cellular respiration, except with different members of the chain. Okay, so that's basically the same thing, even though it's a different kind of chain. Now, photosystem 1, which remember is the second one in line, meanwhile receives excitation from a different photon from sunlight. All right? Resonance energy transfer bounces that excitation around till it reaches its reaction center complex. It loses its electron to a primary acceptor in that photosystem. And it passes it down to another electron transport chain, but a shorter one. And those electrons don't pump protons to produce ATP. Instead, at the end of this shorter chain, NADP plus receives the electrons and some protons from solution to reduce it into NADPH. Okay? Both of these things, ATP and NADPH, are carrying energy. These are the two energy-carrying chemicals required for the second part of photosynthesis. And this is how the light reactions makes these two energy-carrying molecules for the light-independent reactions. All right? Now, here's how they're linked together, though. Whenever either of these chlorophylls in the reaction center loses an electron, it really, really wants an electron back. Now, it's not going to be the electron that it just lost, because that went to the primary electron acceptor and gets passed along. But it's a very unstable condition for this reaction center chlorophyll to not have that electron. All electrons are the same, though, so it doesn't care where it gets the electron, as long as it gets an electron back. All right. Now, in the second photosystem, which is photosystem 1, it can be replaced. The electron that it loses is replaced by the one that's trickling down through the electron transport chain between the two photosystems. So it's a different electron, but it doesn't matter. Goes back to the reaction center chlorophyll that lost it. But let's look at what happened earlier in photosystem 2. This one lost it, and it's not receiving an electron from a chain from another photosystem. Instead, the electron that's lost from the reaction center complex chlorophyll in photosystem 2 comes from water that gets enzymatically split in the chloroplast. Remember that water is an input, a material input into the light-dependent reactions. You have energy as an input, that's not material, that's sunlight. And you have water. I told you last time that water is required for photosynthesis mainly because of the hydrogen. It needs electrons. And it gets those electrons from the hydrogen that's in water. So first it has to split the water into oxygen and hydrogen. When you take the hydrogens off of the oxygen, you output oxygen. That's why oxygen is a waste product, a byproduct of photosynthesis. Okay? Simply because you've removed the hydrogens that you need as an energy, as an electron source, and what's left is oxygen. The hydrogens then get split into protons and electrons. And the electron from a hydrogen that was originally in water is what replaces the electron that gets removed when it gets excited by sunlight. So in photosystem 1, the second one, its electron gets replaced by an electron that's coming down the chain between the two photosystems. But in photosystem 2, the first one, its electron gets replaced by an electron that came from a hydrogen in water. Any questions on that? Yeah.
In the photosystem 1, how come it's still showing light entering it?
Because it does. Mm-hmm. These are separate photons from sunlight. The excitation in photosystem 1 here is because of sunlight.
Right.
And so it has to be excited just like this one does. Eventually that reaches the center, and it's that excitation that makes the electron leave. But what puts an electron back to re-satisfy this is the electron that was originally in this photosystem and came down through the electron transport chain.
Okay, so that one's already getting its own electron, but it gets the second one from the other acceptor then?
Well, yeah, the replacement one for this one is trickling from the other photosystem. This one doesn't have another photosystem supplying it.
Right.
So the electron that has to be replaced here comes from water. After you split water into hydrogen and oxygen and then split the hydrogens. And so as long as you have sunlight and water, this will continue to operate. Electrons will continue to go through the chain between the two photosystems creating ATP. And electrons will go through the second chain continuously creating NADPH. Those are exactly the two requirements for the second part of photosynthesis. So this is a transduction. Transduce means to change from one form of energy to another. It transduces light energy into the chemical energy of ATP and NADPH. Okay? All right, well then, let's look at a cartoon that kind of analogizes this, slide 12. These huge photon hammers are the energy being received from sunlight. That's exciting the reaction centers. They lose their electrons, and then she drops it off to an electron transport chain that, after pumping protons, has the effect of causing the diffusion through the ATP synthase molecules to create ATP. Meanwhile, the second one gets excited as well, but that electron is really coming from the electron transport chain. And then the second electron transport chain makes NADPH. Both of the requirements for the Calvin cycle. Now, 13. What we just looked at and what I just explained, meaning how everything operated as I've said it, is what's called non-cyclic electron flow. It's non-cyclic because it goes in one direction from beginning to end through both photosystems. Or I should say, through both electron transport chains. Okay? If non-cyclic electron flow, which is what this kind of grayed out part represents, the whole process, if that operates, non-cyclic electron flow, then both of these high energy molecules are produced, ATP and NADPH. The problem with this is that they're produced in a 1-to-1 ratio. Just the same amount of ATP is produced as NADPH. It is true that the second part of photosynthesis requires both, but it doesn't require them in equal amounts. It requires more ATP than NADPH. So if you produce them in a 1-to-1 ratio, you can look at it either of two ways. You're either producing too much NADPH or not enough ATP, right? Because you really need to produce it with a 3-to-2 ratio of ATP to NADPH. And therefore, these pairs of photosystems and the electron transport chains between them don't operate only for non-cyclic electron flow. There is also an alternative mechanism called cyclic electron flow, which is what we're looking at here in the non-grayed out part. Cyclic electron flow happens the same way with respect to photosystem 1. It gets excited. The electron, instead though of going down this second electron transport chain, gets fed back to the electron transport chain between the photosystems. And so as light keeps coming in and exciting it, the electron keeps going around and around. And therefore, the only one of these electron transport chains, the first one, operates. And therefore, only ATP is produced, not NADPH. Do you see why? The electron that is being received by this primary electron acceptor of photosystem 1 would normally be dumped off to this second chain. Instead, it's being dumped off to the first chain for another round. And so if you do only that, all you're producing is ATP. You're not producing any NADPH. Now, I don't want you to think that certain pairs of photosystems operate for cyclic and certain pairs operate for non-cyclic. That's not true. Any pair of photosystems can operate either cyclically or non-cyclically. They just switch off between, depending on the requirements of the plant. And the plant doesn't have to think about this. It's automatic. I told you that the Calvin cycle requires both NADPH and ATP, but not in equal amounts. So if you operate for non-cyclic electron flow and give the second part of photosynthesis equal amounts, it will use up all the ATP because it needs more of that, and it'll have a bunch of extra NADPH. Right? Does that make sense? Eventually, you'll have so much NADPH that there's no empty NADP. In other words, there's no NADP plus anymore. Staying with me? When there's no empty taxis for NADPH, or for NADP, then they can't pick up anything in this, and that's what shuts this second electron transport chain down automatically. It will only operate if you have an empty taxi. Once they're all full, then this one will automatically shut down, and the only place this electron can go is back for another ride through the electron transport chain between the photosystems, and that will produce only ATP for a while until you have enough and it starts using up the NADPH, which empties up some taxis, and this one will turn back on automatically. It'll automatically switch to non-cyclic electron flow. So it ends up that it gives the light-independent reaction is exactly the ratio of NADPH and ATP that it needs. Okay. Let's go to 14 and compare these electron transport chains as they operate in the mitochondrion for cellular respiration and in the chloroplast for photosynthesis. Really, they, like I said, they're, even though they're structurally they're slightly different, functionally they are identical. So this box on the bottom represents two chambers separated by the membrane. If you think of this box and the electron transport chain in it as being in a mitochondrion, then the dark gray chamber is the intermembrane space that the protons get pumped into. The light gray is the matrix where they get pumped from. The membrane itself is the inner membrane of the mitochondrion. And diffusion of protons happens from the intermembrane space back into the matrix to create ATP. But if you think of and the dark and light represent the chambers in the two compartments in the mitochondrion. If you think of it as a chloroplast, on the other hand, then the membrane is the thylakoid membrane. The light gray, notice, is the stroma. The stroma is inside the inner membrane, but outside of the thylakoids. That's where the protons get pumped from. They get pumped into the thylakoid space, inside the thylakoids, that's what the dark gray is, and that's where they then diffuse from back into the stroma. You know, high proton concentration in here, they come back out to spin the rotors of the ATP synthase to produce the ATP. So the organelles are different, the compartments have different names, but it operates the same way. You can put it all together in slide 15. This is just one of many, many copies of these of a pair of photosystems and the associated electron transport chains. The light is separate photons, exciting different chlorophylls in different photosystems. They have reaction center chlorophylls that lose their electrons. This first one is replaced by an electron that comes from the hydrogen of water. That produces oxygen in the process. The electron trickles down through the electron transport chain, produces ATP when the protons that get pumped in here leave back out into the stroma to spin the rotors. And the second electron transport chain that receives electron from photosystem 1 is used to reduce NADP plus into NADPH. Both of these are the requirements for the Calvin cycle. And they're produced in the right ratio because this will switch back and forth automatically between non-cyclic and cyclic electron flow. How's that seem? Does it make sense? Okay. Let's then go on to the Calvin cycle itself, or the light-independent reactions. This is this really special, ecologically special part of photosynthesis because this is where carbon fixation occurs. That's the trick that we can't do as consumers. As the name implies, this is a cycle just like the citric acid cycle is. It's a pathway that feeds back onto itself, in other words. So just like the citric acid cycle, you can think of this 12 o'clock position as a start-finish line. And remember that the material input into the light-independent reactions is carbon dioxide, the carbon source in inorganic form. So you have CO2 coming in. All right? The end of this cycle features an intermediate called ribulose bisphosphate. All right, notice that it is a five-carbon compound. Ribulose bisphosphate. It has two phosphates, that's why it's called bisphosphate. But a five-carbon, well, it is a sugar, but it's a five-carbon intermediate. That then gets carbon dioxide added to it at the start-finish line. And so you're taking a 5-carbon compound, adding another carbon from CO2 to produce a very transient or short-lived intermediate that is 6 carbons big. It lasts such a short time that they didn't even give it a real name. It probably does have a name. I just don't know what it is. But it's very, very unstable. So as soon as that 6-carbon compound is made by adding that additional carbon from CO2, it immediately degrades into 2-3-carbon ones as part of the process. But that's what happens at the start-finish line. Now, the overall cycle, and I don't care about every one of these steps, like I don't want you to memorize glycolysis, but the overall cycle, notice, has 3 important phases to it. The first part of which is carbon fixation. So right here at the start-finish line is where carbon fixation occurs, because you have carbon in inorganic form, CO2, and as soon as it gets incorporated into this 6-carbon sugar, it's already an organic compound, right? That's the carbon fixation step. Phase 2 is reduction. Specifically, we're talking about the fact that as these intermediates change, there's steps that produce energy-carrying compounds. You make some ATP, but you also make some NADPH by reducing NADP+. All right? I'm sorry, by oxidizing NADPH into NADP+, you are reducing the intermediates. Sorry, it's the opposite of what happens in the citric acid cycle. Right? The citric acid cycle produces energy. This is requiring energy. So the ATP gets spent producing ADP, and the NADPH gets spent producing NADP+, allowing these intermediates to be formed to go on in this pathway. Remember that building the sugar out of CO2 is expensive. It requires external energy. It's endergonic. So that's phase 2, reduction of the intermediates. At the bottom, notice, as long as this continues to go around, every now and then a 3-carbon sugar will be taken off. That's why you have to have 3 CO2s enter one at a time at the top. That's 3 carbons, and then those eventually leave as a 3-carbon sugar from the bottom. And this is why it's not strictly true to say that the material output of photosynthesis itself is glucose. Glucose is a 6-carbon sugar. What photosynthesis directly produces is a 3-carbon sugar called G3P, glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, is what G3P stands for. But G3P is its nickname. That is already an organic compound. And once you have organic compounds, then you can rearrange them into other organic compounds. So even though photosynthesis is done when the G3P is produced, you can then go on and produce glucose. It's really after photosynthesis that happens. Okay? So this is the goal, right? Making this sugar, which is valuable stuff as fuel or as building blocks for anything else that the plant needs. But that's not the end of the cycle. There's also phase 3, which is so-called regeneration of the CO2 acceptor. Well, this ribulose bisphosphate that I was talking about, 5-carbon compound, is the CO2 acceptor. By receiving CO2, that's what fixes the carbon, it becomes a 6-carbon intermediate. And so you have to have that continuously available if you want to have this cycle continue on. You have to regenerate or reform this ribulose bisphosphate. And so that requires some ATP, as you see. All right, so there's only 1 phosphate here. Now there are 2. That came from ATP, that additional phosphate. You can see here that no sunlight directly is involved here. It's indirectly involved, though, because this whole cycle will shut down if you don't have both ATP and NADPH. And you can see here that you need more ATP than you need NADPH, which is why you switch between cyclic and non-cyclic electron flow in the light-dependent reactions. So yes, this can operate for a while in darkness, but only until you run out of NADPH and ATP. Then you have to rely on the light-dependent reactions to make you more. Okay, now, the only important thing here that I didn't mention is this box right here, Rubisco, which I prefer to write as capital R, U, capital B, I, S, capital C, O, or capital C, capital O. And that's because Rubisco is just a nickname for an enzyme. Rubisco is an acronym that stands for ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxygenase. And its full name shows you that it's an enzyme. The acronym doesn't end in ASE, but the full name has ASE in it. In fact, it has two ASEs in it. And that's an important point about Rubisco. Ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxygenase is not only an enzyme, it's an enzyme that can operate functionally in two different ways. It can operate as a carboxylase, or it can operate as an oxygenase. When it's operating as a carboxylase, which is what the plant wants it to operate as, it's called a carboxylase because it's catalyzing the addition of a carboxyl, CO2, onto ribulose bisphosphate to produce this intermediate and allowing all the rest of it to happen, including the production of the sugar. Okay? That's why I said that's what the plant wants to happen. Unfortunately, carbon dioxide is not the only thing that can come in here and momentarily hook onto the enzyme and then get attached to ribulose bisphosphate. Oxygen also can. That's why it also can operate as an oxygenase. And if oxygen comes in and gets added to ribulose bisphosphate instead of carbon dioxide coming in, there's a couple problems with that. One is that you don't make this 6-carbon short-lived intermediate because you haven't added any more carbon when oxygen comes in, right? And therefore, you don't make any sugar. It disrupts this carbon cycle, this Calvin cycle. So that's bad enough because the goal is to make sugar. But even worse than that, the intermediate that gets produced when you add oxygen to ribulose bisphosphate instead has to be undone, basically. You have to spend energy in the form of ATP to get it back to ribulose bisphosphate so that the Calvin cycle can operate correctly. So you not only don't make sugar, but you also waste ATP that you would normally spend making sugar. And both of those are problematic to the plant. It can't help it, though, because not only does this enzyme, Rubisco, accept oxygen or carbon dioxide, but it actually has a higher affinity for oxygen than it does carbon dioxide. So if they're in equal concentrations, oxygen and carbon dioxide, oxygen will win out more often than not. That problematic incorporation of oxygen instead of CO2 is called photorespiration. It got this name respiration simply because it involves the same gases as respiration does, CO2 and O2. But photorespiration is problematic. It's wasteful to the plant because it doesn't make sugar, plus it wastes ATP to get back to normal. Well, thankfully, some plants have evolved ways to get around this problem of photorespiration. Not all plants, but some have. And they've been really successful because of that. Here you have what is called a C4 plant, as opposed to a C3 plant would be an ordinary plant that does not have any way to prevent photorespiration. This is called a C4 plant because there's a 4-carbon compound that's involved. That's where the C4 comes from. But what's different about this is that if you think back to that slide where I showed you the leaves and the mesophyll cells were the filling of the sandwich, and that's really all there were in the filling is these mesophyll cells, not arranged in any special way. In a C4 plant, you have mesophyll cells arranged superficially toward the surfaces, and deeper in you have so-called bundle sheath cells. Bundle sheath cells don't appear in the C3 plants. Okay? But you see these bundle sheath cells are deeper, meaning they're farther away from the atmosphere. Okay, now let's look at these two types of cells in detail. This is a mesophyll cell, as you see. This is a bundle sheath cell. There's still carbon fixation, but what happens is that the CO2 comes in and gets fixed by combining to an intermediate in this first cycle that wouldn't be operating in a C3 plant under the enzymatic help of something called PEP carboxylase. It's a carboxylase only. Rubisco is a carboxylase or an oxygenase, right? That's the whole problem. This one can't take oxygen. So it doesn't matter that oxygen is here because this mesophyll cell is right by the atmosphere. Oxygen won't interfere because even though it's there, it won't fit into this enzyme. So only CO2 gets incorporated here. Okay? This is not the Calvin cycle, but the carbon that gets taken in as CO2 in this cycle is going to be delivered through plasmodesmata to the bundle sheath cell that is deeper in the leaf. All right, so notice the CO2 gets incorporated temporarily, and then once it's in this other cell, the bundle sheath cell, the CO2 comes back out, and then that goes to the Calvin cycle. But by then, this is so deep in the leaf that there isn't much oxygen around because it's not right next to the atmosphere. And so this CO2 gets incorporated by Rubisco's help, which could use either carbon dioxide or oxygen, but there's not much oxygen here, so it makes it a lot more efficient. It avoids most of the photorespiration that is harmful to the plant, wasteful to the plant. Okay, the rest of it operates the same way as I just told you for a C3 plant, and the sugar gets produced. So in other words, the way that C4 plants have evolved the mechanism around this photorespiration problem is that they separate carbon fixation from the Calvin cycle. A C3 plant, the Calvin cycle is where carbon gets fixed, right? In a C4 plant, they separate carbon fixation from the Calvin cycle, and the way that they separate it is spatially, meaning into separate spaces, separate cells. But that's not the only way that you can separate it. So in 18, we have a C4 plant that we just studied on the left. separating carbon fixation from Calvin cycle spatially, separating them into two separate compartments. A different kind of plant, though, a different group of plants, solved this evolutionarily in a different way. They also separate carbon fixation from the Calvin cycle, but they separate it temporally, in time, not in space. Okay? So this is one cell here. That's why it's not a spatial separation. These are the so-called CAM plants. CAM is another acronym. It stands for crassulation acid metabolism. Now, the crassulations are simply the plants that they discovered this in. That doesn't mean they're the only ones that can do it, but that's where the C came from. And it's called acid metabolism because it involves an organic acid to temporarily store the CO2. All right, so these CAM plants close down their stomata during the day. Remember, the stomata are the little pores in the leaves that allow for gas exchange. They open them up at night, they close them during the day. Now, this is helpful for a different reason entirely. These CAM plants tend to live in very hot environments. And if you have your stomata open during the day, then not only... then you have the additional problem of losing more water by evaporation, which can kill you. So they close these stomata during the day, which has the advantage, unrelated advantage, of saving water for them. But the reason they're shutting them down during the day is so that they won't be accumulating oxygen at that point. All right? They open them up at night, CO2 comes in and gets incorporated into an organic acid just like it does up here in the mesophyll cell. Remember, that's PEP carboxylase, so oxygen can't interfere with that. And they just produce a bunch of organic acid during the day, storing the carbon that came from CO2. All right? Then they close down their stomata the next morning. And at that point, oxygen can't get in to interfere. And the organic acid that they made the previous night gets degraded to release the CO2 that it was storing. So the CO2 is, CO2 and oxygen can't get into the plant at all because the stomata are closed. But this CO2 comes from the previous day's organic acid that accumulated. And then that goes into the normal Calvin cycle so that oxygen can't interfere because oxygen is not getting in anymore. And that produces the sugar. So they solve the problem, these two different plant groups solve the problem of photorespiration in entirely different ways. C4 plants separate carbon fixation from the Calvin cycle spatially. And CAM plants separate carbon fixation from the Calvin cycle temporally. Any questions on that? All right. Let's look at 19 then, which I think might be the last slide. This is just a summary slide. So we're through all the material, but let's go through this again to make sense of the whole process. In goal terms, what photosynthesis is trying to do is to fix carbon from the inorganic source CO2 into the organic form of G3P, a three-carbon compound that can then be converted into all kinds of other organic compounds. Doing that, of course, is an expensive process, right? It's anabolic. It's producing a larger molecule out of simpler ones. And that should cost energy. It does. Energy ultimately comes from the sun, but not directly, right? The part of photosynthesis that produces the sugar out of CO2 is the second part. It's the light-independent reactions. And they do that does require energy, but not light energy. It requires energy in the form of ATP and NADPH. Both of which drive the fixation of CO2 into G3P. Now, this is listed as sucrose. That's after photosynthesis produces the G3P. That's an example of most plants transport the sugars that they make for later use as fuels in the form of sucrose, table sugar, you know, which is why when you tap a maple tree to get sap for syrup, it's mostly sucrose. They do this, though, to put into the vessels, just like our blood vessels, to transport it to the other parts of the plant that aren't ever seeing any sunlight. The roots have to live and eat, too. They never see any sunlight, so the sucrose gets transported to them. But anyway, this is the expensive part of the process of photosynthesis, expensive in terms of ATP and NADPH both being required. Those two energy-carrying molecules get spent by the Calvin cycle. And when ATP gets spent, that means it gets dephosphorylated. So the Calvin cycle will output ADP and inorganic phosphate after using the ATP energy. And when it uses the NADPH energy, it will reoxidize NADPH into NADP+. These are the lower energy versions of these two energy-carrying molecules. And those then go to the first part of photosynthesis, the light-dependent reactions, for the transduction of energy from light form into chemical form. So NADP+ gets re-reduced back into NADPH, and ADP gets phosphorylated into ATP so that those can go back to the Calvin cycle and allow more sugar to be produced. Just will continue over and over as long as light is striking it. But importantly, even with light striking it, you can't produce the ATP and the NADPH without a steady stream of electrons, right? Because it's electron transport that causes both of those things to happen, production of NADPH and production of ATP. And the steady stream of electrons needs to come from the hydrogens that are in water originally, that gets split into hydrogen and oxygen. That's why oxygen comes out of the process. And the hydrogens themselves get split into protons and electrons. Electrons get passed down the chains. Protons get pumped through the chains to produce the gradient, just like in cellular respiration. Any part of this not make any sense? You sure? That is the unit, then. So you are armed with the knowledge necessary to get a 100% on Thursday. Okay.